Hayes Muhib in Washington.
How big is the threat to media freedom around the world? From anti-press rhetoric by political leaders and disinformation campaigns to violence against journalists and the influence of social media, what does the future hold for mainstream media? Also, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has US-Africa relations in the spotlight. Could we see African countries push for a new type of non-aligned movement? We'll bring you a special interview with a counselor of the U.S. State Department, Derek Chollet. He'll tell us what the United States makes of some African countries' silence on critical United Nations votes to punish Russia. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Heidi Adams. How free is the media where you live? Are journalists able to report on stories that are of public interest or on the successes and failures of your country's leadership without fear or favor? Or are they censored, harassed, jailed, or even killed? Well, that is our focus today. And we begin in Ethiopia with a case that serves as a reminder of the dangers many reporters face every day. An Ethiopian journalist accused of aiding and abetting a government-designated terrorist group, all because of his reporting on rebels. Advocates say his story highlights Ethiopia's decline in media freedom. VOA's Salem Solomon has more.
Amir Aman Kiaro is back home with his family after a four-month ordeal in an Ethiopian prison. But the video journalist for the Associated Press could still face jail if convicted of violating anti-terrorism and wartime state of emergency laws. First arrested in November, Amir is accused of illegally communicating with members of a group the government designated as a terrorist organization. Under a state of emergency that was in place until February, journalists could be penalized for interviewing members of armed groups, including the Oromo Liberation Army. Amir and a freelancer, Thomas Ingida, were detained but never charged, the AP says.
The crackdown on the media that this case represents, there is truly no true accusation that can be leveled against Amir. He is a respected, balanced journalist who has covered both sides of the conflict. He's been picked up, and this is an arbitrary detention.
With a shrinking space for reporting, several Ethiopian journalists called on the government to respect media rights. In 2021 alone, their open letter says 46 journalists were detained, making Ethiopia one of the worst jailers of journalists in Africa.
The general optimism that we had a couple of years ago with the much-heralded reform, with the promises that journalists would be able to operate unperturbed, this has not panned out. The promises and the pledges did not materialize. And unfortunately, for journalists, the situation is starting to mirror what we saw in 2009 when Ethiopia passed its infamous anti-terror proclamation, which was used to round up journalists en masse. So we had to speak up about a very, very dire situation that our colleagues on the ground in Ethiopia are facing.
With little coverage of daily life in rebel-controlled regions like Oromia, the work of reporters like Amir is vital, says Zakarias.
Very few journalists have been able to gain access to areas under control of the OLA. And what life has been like for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people in these areas, much of which have been subjected to internet and phone outages, we don't have an accurate picture of.
Amir's lawyer, Tadela Gebremedin, says his client has been ordered to not leave the country until the case is investigated. He's accused of working with foreign media outlets and, quote, spoiling the country's development plans, end quote, through negative reporting. VOA reached out to the Office of the Prime Minister, the Communications Ministry, and the Attorney General's office requesting comment, but received no response. Phillips says it's important to shine a light on cases like this.
We will continue to cover the story of journalists who are unjustly held. This is not acceptable behavior. These are arbitrary detentions. If there is proof of something, then that evidence has to be surfaced and has to go through a proper trial process. It's something that is extremely important to us at the AP and to our peer news organizations.
For now, Amir is free, but the risk of arrest for those in media is ever present. Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
Well, May 3rd marks World Press Freedom Day. It's a chance to highlight the importance of a free press and pay tribute to journalists who have died in the line of duty. It's also a reminder to governments, policymakers, and society to uphold and protect media freedoms as a cornerstone of a democratic society. But according to media watchdog Freedom House, press freedom has deteriorated worldwide over the past 10 years. Some of the most prominent and influential democracies have seen populist leaders attempt to stifle the freedom and independence of the press. So what is the state of media freedom across Africa and in other parts of the world? And joining me now to discuss this is Jessica Jarit. She's the press freedom editor here at The Voice of America. And with us via Skype is Angela Quintal. She's the Africa program coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists. And she joins us from New York. Angela, Jessica, so welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
Jessica, I'm going to start with you. As we said earlier, of course, May 3rd marks Press Freedom Day. And this year's theme is Journalism Under Digital Siege. Why this theme? What's behind it? And what does it tell us about the state of press freedom around the world?
I think that theme this year really just is showing the ramping up of laws and attempts to silence the sort of digital sphere. So many of us are getting our news through news websites, through our phone apps now. And as soon as this technology advances, governments seem to find ways to suppress that information. We've seen a range of tactics really coming up in the past year. We've seen governments who have sought to do communications blackouts if there's times in unrest. We've seen that in Myanmar with the coup, in Tigray and Ethiopia with the reporting, and Moscow with its war in Ukraine very quickly sought to ban news websites and cut off other access to social media and ways that people are communicating.
Angela, please give us the lay of the land in the sort of African context. How would you rate press freedom across Africa? And where, in your view, do journalists really have it the hardest?
Well, it's really a mixed bag, but I guess certainly in terms of what Jessica has said, and we've seen the world over, press freedom is deteriorating in Africa. And we just have to look at the Committee to Protect Journalists research, even in terms of the jailing of journalists, the murder of journalists. And so when I talk about a mixed bag, if I look at CPJ's prison census, which is a snapshot of the number of journalists that are jailed around the globe on the 1st of December each year, in Africa, it's really a bad news story. In terms of our revised figures, we have about 80 journalists in jail, the majority of them in Egypt. But it's in sub-Saharan Africa that we have seen a deterioration. And certainly, you were talking about Ethiopia. And really, Ethiopia is the bad news story, because there was so much hope when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came into power. Prime Minister Abiy, I mean, you know, if we look at the fact that it's World Press Freedom Day in a couple of days' time on May 3rd, when Ethiopia was actually hosting World Press Freedom Day in Addis in 2019, the Prime Minister made a big show about the fact that there were no journalists in jail, for example, in Ethiopia. And this was after years of Ethiopia actually being one of the worst jailer of journalists. And less than 3 years later, here we are. In terms of our revised figures for our for the number of jailed journalists in Ethiopia, we actually had 14 in sub-Saharan Africa, that making Ethiopia, after Eritrea, the second worst jailer of journalists. So that's really a cause of concern, and just shows how political upheaval and conflict invariably, one will see that there is a crackdown. And that's certainly what we saw in Ethiopia with the state of emergency. Most of the journalists that had been jailed in Ethiopia were jailed after the state of emergency was announced in November. But as I say, it's throughout the continent. You know, even in countries that generally do not make the international radar. If you look at Benin, where we had two journalists, again, you're talking about the Press Freedom Day theme, journalism under digital siege. You see the use of cybercrime legislation to target journalists. And in Benin, that was the case. You actually had two journalists in jail because of their reporting and the fact that their reporting was then distributed online.
You know, I always wonder, Jessica, whether we as journalists perhaps care a little more about other journalists than the general public does. So to give people some insight into what journalists go to, can you tell us about the threats and the dangers that journalists face in many parts of the world in their daily life in the course of just doing their work?
Of course. So, I mean, obviously, journalists, we work for our audiences. That's our whole point of being, is to help our audiences understand and make sense of the world around them. But in doing that, in doing something as simple as covering a government press conference or a protest or unrest, we're seeing time and again that journalists are arrested, are physically attacked. Harassment on the online sphere just for people disagreeing with your point of view or for just pointing out that there's corruption and wrongdoing and trying to shine a light on some of these sort of egregious crimes. And the journalists are the ones who suddenly find that they are being penalised instead of the perpetrators of a crime. I think this year particularly in Mexico, where they have, there's so much happening there, if you think about the drug trafficking and violence and organised crime, and the journalists who are really risking their lives every day to go out into their communities and report on that and to say what's happening, and they can find themselves kidnapped, attacked, arrested, even killed. We've had 8 journalists so far this year killed just for reporting, just trying to explain to their communities about the violence and crime affecting them.
Angela, I want to move to social media and the rise of social media, especially across the African continent, with more and more people now having access. How has that changed or affected the importance of the mainstream media?
I think that the mainstream media remains important in Africa, but the mainstream media also understands that social media is a platform that is important, and so you'll see that most of the mainstream media do use social media for their journalism. But you've also seen an increase in other smaller media, media that are not necessarily seen as part of the traditional media, using social media as an important platform. And that is why you see the crackdown on social media. When you see countries passing laws because they see social media as a threat. So governments, for example, have, and certainly in Abuja, in about 2 years back, I think you had intelligent chiefs from all over Africa meeting and seeing social media as a threat. And later you actually had the Southern African Development Community issuing a statement saying that social media was a real threat and that this needed to be somehow controlled. And so you have seen a rise in legislation, in cybercrime laws, in social media laws, in an attempt to try and control the narrative, to try and control that space. It's a massive crackdown on civic space. And so what we've seen is more and more journalists actually being arrested and charged under cybercrime laws for things like false news, simply for doing journalism, and because the government may feel that this is not something that suits their narrative, the thing that they will do is they will throw false news laws at journalists and will imprison them. So we've seen an increase in the number of false news charges around the world against journalists, and particularly in Africa. Egypt and Cameroon certainly has, over the years, we've seen most of the journalists who've been jailed have been jailed on false news charges. And the other big, big concern, and I think Jessica did touch on it, is the online violence and the abuse against journalists and social media. So while social media can be good for journalism and for journalists to get their message across, it has also been weaponized against the press, and in particular against female journalists. And that's been a huge concern. In fact, in a couple of days, UNESCO is going to publish an important report, and it's a report looking at how the how online violence is being perpetrated against particularly female journalists, and there have been vicious attacks. And that has had a knock-on effect. You've seen women journalists who've actually left the profession. You've seen women who have been physically harassed because of the online harassment. So there is that. And then you also see the massive trauma to those journalists who are online and are, in fact, the victims of massive, massive government trolling, but not only government trolling. Anyone who feels that they are being targeted will see the journalist as the one way to try and deflect attention. And that's what we saw, for example, in South Africa, where opposition parties who've been exposed for corruption have turned their members against journalists and actually used that platform to try and undermine the journalism that is being done to expose the corruption that we see in the country.
Jessica, Angela spoke earlier about how laws are used to persecute journalists. But what about anti-media rhetoric? And we've seen examples in the United States. We've seen examples across Africa, in Europe. Some of the most prominent democracies, we see very influential politicians, not just in the political scene, but also in places of worship, we see people purport this type of anti-media rhetoric. When we hear phrases like fake news, or we've heard here in the United States the lamestream media, things like that, all those sort of derogatory terms. How damaging, given their influence, how damaging are these remarks to journalists and the work that they do?
Do you think that hostile rhetoric that we've been seeing from leaders, and it is sort of across the board, we've seen it in the US, we've seen it in the Philippines, we've seen it in Mexico, that it's damaging on a series of levels. One, it is sort of this further erosion of trust in media that we've been seeing in recent years. If you keep discrediting, if you keep trying to say that the media are being biased, they're only reporting from one side, then readers and audiences start to doubt the information they're given. And for a hostile government, that can be a very to their advantage, because it gives them an opening to just say, well, just come to me for the news. We'll speak to you directly. But then you miss that really vital part of what a journalist's role is, which is to ask the tricky questions, to push back if a spokesperson is telling you that a situation is one way and you don't have any opportunity to push back, to ask, to point out that what you're seeing is actually a very different reality, then we're losing that very sort of vital role that a journalist plays. But the other issue there as well, and Angela touched on this with the online harassment and violence, is that supporters of governments or a religious group or any sort of influential group or powerful interest, their supporters amplify that message. And then you get into this very dangerous sphere of journalists being attacked and harassed online. There's always the risk of that becoming real world violence. And at the heart of it, all they're trying to do is to stop information coming out that a journalist has. So it's not just really an attack on a journalist when you're trying to discredit or harm a journalist. What you're also trying to do is to block that information. It's an attack on your right to know.
It's in a time where we are increasingly, Angela, seeing people being told, don't listen to what the media shows and tells you, don't believe your lying eyes. And we really see the breakdown of trust between the public and the media. How do you build trust with the public? And how do you rebuild it in places where it has broken down?
I think, and that's the main, that's a huge concern, is this disconnect between the trust deficit between the media and the public. But what we have seen is that good journalism is appreciated by the public. And so often where you have had journalists losing their jobs, mainstream newsrooms actually closing down, you've seen new media actually starting up, and you have seen that the support for that is actually coming from members of the public who see a need to have accurate and credible news. And so that's the good news story out of all of this. While we may see that traditional media is under threat, you are actually seeing new forms of media being created and that there is that support from the public for good, credible and accurate journalism. And I think, you know, it's important for people not to lose the plot in the sense that when you see that journalism and ensuring that press freedom is there, it's not actually for journalists. It's actually for the greater public good. It is for the public to know what is going on. And when that is appreciated and when they see the effect of good journalism, and again, I'll turn to South Africa. South Africa, we were in a situation in a country where we had a president who was effectively in the pocket of a powerful family. And no one was in the public wanted to necessarily believe that until it was the journalists who were exposing that corruption and putting it on the front pages of newspapers, sharing it online. And, you know, there was a commission of inquiry that came out and proved that what the journalists had been reporting on for as many years as they had been doing was actually correct. And it was a real boon for the way that journalism was perceived in South Africa, because suddenly investigative journalism was seen to be important and you had a lot of support, including financial support, for investigative journalists who were doing their work in the country. And we've seen that across the continent and worldwide as well.
That's a very good example there, Gupta Gate and Jacob Zuma. We have just a minute and a half left. Very quickly, Angela, are there scenarios or examples where that make you feel really hopeful on the continent, where we're actually seeing investment in training journalists, in training journalists as fact checkers, and really investing in the work that they're doing?
Well, I'll give you an example of how investigative journalism is being supported throughout the continent. And you really do see that. And we've seen great examples of cooperation between journalists in various countries who are working to expose, corruption, from the West Africa leaks to what's going on in Southern Africa. We've also seen, countries where in the past was seen as the bad news story, where Ethiopia is currently. I mean, I just have to look, for example, at the Gambia and see how things have improved there now that Yahya Jammeh is no longer in power. And certainly you see a much freer media. So there are good news stories. We have Namibia as well, where, you know, press freedom remains pretty strong. And then you have, when it comes to impunity in crimes against journalists in particular, particularly when it comes to the murder of journalists, I think the one thing that we're all watching right now is what's happening in Germany, because there was the famous journalist Dada Haidara in the Gambia who was killed by a hit squad of the then president Yahya Jammeh, and they actually have one of the junglers, which is a member of the hit squad, currently on trial in Germany. And that, the mere fact that there is someone on trial in another country shows that, in fact, those who are guilty of crimes against journalists cannot hide, that somehow the international community will actually take action if domestic laws don't do that.
Well, we're going to end on that positive note with those very good examples. Angela Quintal and Jessica Jarid, thank you both for being here with me. I do appreciate your insights, your perspectives and your time.
Thank you.
Well, still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa, my interview with U.S. State Department Counselor Derek Chollet about Russia's war in Ukraine and what it could mean for U.S.-African relations. We'll also discuss whether African countries might be thinking about a new kind of non-aligned movement. We'll have all of that when we come back.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. At the United Nations, Africa is a 54-vote block. That's large enough to swing resolutions. But so far, when it has come to UN resolutions led by the United States to punish Russia for its invasion of Ukraine, African votes have been mixed and divided. For example, on the suspension of Russia, from the Human Rights Council, you remember that, 9 African countries voted against, 23 abstained, 11 didn't vote at all, and only 11 backed it. So how will the stance of African countries affect their relationship with the United States? I put that question, among others, to Derek Chollet. He is the counselor and a top advisor to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. I spoke recently with Chollet at the U.S. State Department here in Washington. We've now had 2 resolutions at the United Nations on Russia and the most recent one around suspending Russia from the Human Rights Council. And African countries clearly not united on this issue. And observers have noted that Russia is likely taking notes. Is the United States taking notes? And how do you read the way African countries voted at the United Nations?
Well, first, we're not taking notes. We understand these are sovereign decisions by countries, and the United States is in constant contact with most members of the United Nations around these critical votes to talk about our views and make the case for why we think it's important for countries to vote the way they do. We think Russia's expulsion from the UN Human Rights Council is completely justified, given what we are seeing out of Ukraine. I mean, the horrors we have seen in places like Bucha, and I'm afraid those are not the last of the horrors we're going to be seeing as the tide recedes inside Ukraine and as Russian troops withdraw further. I think we're only going to uncover more atrocities, more crimes against humanity inside Russia. So it's quite significant that the United Nations took the step, only the second time in the UN Human Rights Council's history is a country being removed from the Human Rights Council. Countries vote for different reasons, and some countries have longstanding relationships with Russia. Some countries are just trying to navigate their way through this very difficult crisis. But yet we think that the overwhelming support of these UN General Assembly votes or the vote to expulse Russia from the UN Human Rights Council sends a very clear message that the international community really is largely speaking with one voice here. That Russia's unprovoked, unjustified invasion of Ukraine needs to be condemned, and there need to be high costs associated with it. That said, we understand that this can put countries in a difficult situation. I mean, countries throughout Africa were already suffering from food crisis and food shortages, and this is only adding to that that hardship. And so that's why the United States, working with others, is committed to doing whatever we can to try to mitigate the impact of the Ukraine war on global food prices, for example.
Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, sent a rather clear message when she said that there is no room for neutrality on the Russia-Ukraine issue. It makes one think of 2001, when then-President George W. Bush told the world that you're either with us or against us in the war on terror, and that there was no room for neutrality then. Is this going to be America's approach at any point?
We just think, given what's going on in Ukraine and Russia's unprovoked, unjustified, brutal war against Ukraine, the cost on thousands, millions of civilians. This is the largest refugee crisis Europe has seen since the Second World War. There are millions of refugees. There are millions more that are displaced within Ukraine, women, children, all innocents. That the world needs to speak out against this. This is a very different situation than 20 years ago and the debates around the Iraq war. And there's unity among the G7 and NATO. This is not just a U.S. cause. This is really a global cause. And this conflict is not just a conflict that's affecting Ukraine. It's not just affecting Europe. It's affecting the world, because the principles at stake, the principles of sovereignty, the principles that states can choose their own destiny, those are principles that every country throughout Africa and all around the world needs to try to uphold. So we don't think this is a time for business as usual. We do not think this is a time for neutrality. We think this is a time that we need to stand together to do whatever we can to support Ukraine, but also ensure that Russia pays a very high price for its decisions.
What do you say to African countries who might fear that what we're essentially looking at here is another proxy battle between the United States and Russia, and that that may again play out on the African continent.
This is not a proxy battle between the United States and Russia. This is an unprovoked, unjustified war that Russia has started against its smaller neighbor, Ukraine. It is conducting that war with great brutality. There are crimes against humanity, and in the U.S. view, there are also war crimes occurring inside Ukraine, perpetrated by Russia. The United States and more than 30 of our NATO and other partners are providing support for Ukraine, in some cases military support, in all cases humanitarian and economic support. So this is the world, the balance of the world. More than 50% of the global economy is represented by the countries who are part of this big coalition to ensure that Russia's behavior is met with resistance, that we're doing what we can to support Ukraine, but that we're also ensuring that Russia pays a high price for its decisions.
U.S. President Joe Biden has said that the U.S. will keep raising the economic cost, keep ratcheting up the pain for Vladimir Putin, and further increase Russia's economic isolation. How does the United States plan to keep the pressure on Putin to help Ukraine defend itself and avoid an escalation of the conflict?
Well, we've been very focused working with our allies and partners. And again, I want to stress that this is not just the United States acting here. We are leading this effort and we are providing the most support, whether we measure that by humanitarian or military support to Ukraine. But there are many, many other countries that are part of this effort. We're very focused on giving Ukraine the kinds of assistance it needs to defend itself and to push Russia back out of their country. We've seen some success thus far where Russia's retreating from key parts of Ukraine. It was trying to surround Kyiv. Now it has largely withdrawn its forces from Kyiv because it was losing. And it was losing first and foremost because of the resilience and bravery of the Ukrainian people, but also because the world, the United States and many, many other countries have been providing Ukraine with military support. We do not seek a direct confrontation with Russia in this crisis. President Biden has been very clear that U.S. troops will not be directly involved. But at the same time, we are committed to giving Ukraine whatever support it needs, the kinds of weapons that it can use now to try to push Russia back out of its country.
If Russia withdraws and calls it quits today, will the sanctions stop?
We believe the sanctions, in large part, will need to remain. Maybe not all of the sanctions, but what we have seen happen, what Russia has already done, they need to pay a high price for that. Again, we have seen the brutal murder of women, children, innocents. And on our screens every day, on our phones, on our televisions, we see these horrible images coming out of Ukraine. There needs to be a price for that, and there needs to be accountability for this. And again, the United States and other countries have said that we believe that there is evidence of war crimes. We are working to collect that evidence, to share it with the right authorities, to ensure that there is accountability for Russia's actions in Ukraine.
As we look at the wider sort of future implications of the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, do you believe that China will see an opportunity here to move on Taiwan?
Well, it's something we're very focused on. We were focused on before this crisis and concerns that China might seek to make a move against Taiwan or seek to at least, at the very least, further destabilize Taiwan in the coming years. Clearly, we're watching this very closely given the current crisis. China, at this point, has made a decision to go all in with Russia, and that's something that I think we all need to be concerned about. Prior to the war, of course, President Xi and Putin met and released a 5,000-word joint statement where they talked about the fact there were no limits in the U.S. or the Russia-China relationship. We have been very clear with the leaders in Beijing that China would not be able to be immune from any costs if they were to assist Russia in trying to evade sanctions or provide material support to Russia to support their efforts in this war. So we are watching very closely what China may do and what lessons they may draw from this crisis. And I think right now, the lesson they should be seeing is that A, there's a high price to be paid for aggression against a neighbor. B, that the world will remain united in ensuring that there is that high price that's going to be paid and that the world will speak with one voice and that the U.S. and our key allies, not just in Europe, but also in Asia, are ready and willing to work together to ensure that we're supporting those who are the victims of any sort of invasion, but also making sure that those who've perpetrated those acts are going to pay a high price.
Derek Chollet, thank you so much for your
thank
time.
You. Really thank you. It was great. Thank you.
And that was Derek Chollet, counselor of the U.S. State Department, speaking to me here in Washington. Now, there are several ways to interpret Africa's divided stance on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But some experts believe it could be a subtle signal for the revival of the non-aligned movement. Do you remember the non-aligned movement, the forum of 120 countries not formally aligned with or against any major power bloc? It persisted throughout the Cold War. But what has happened to it since? And could African countries be trying to revive the idea? Might they be considering a new type of non-aligned movement? Well, joining me now to discuss this is Piwoku Shlemnyandu. He is a professor in the African Studies Department at Howard University. He is also my fellow South African. Piwoku Shle, thank you so much for being here. Friend of the show, you are a very familiar face here. Thank you for your time.
It's good to be here.
Piwo, please remind us, what was the significance of the non-aligned movement? We know it was founded in Belgrade and then Yugoslavia in 1961, but why were African countries part of NAM?
Well, I'd say we can even go further back in history. 1955, the Bandung Conference, and out of that came five principles that kind of basically became the bedrock of what non-aligned movement would be. Mutual non-aggression, non-interference in each other's affairs, mutual benefit and equality, respect for each other's sovereignty, peaceful coexistence. And ironically, this came out of the Sino-India War Agreement. So in other words, then, the African countries found it quite intriguing to have these principles and to be able to promulgate their independent struggle based on these, because they kind of saw that there would be countries soon. Let's not forget, only five countries that attended the Bandung Conference, African countries, were independent. That's Egypt, Ethiopia, Libya, what's the other one? I think Sudan. So there were not a lot of African countries that were quite independent at this time. Liberia is the fifth one.
What has happened then to the movement since? You and I were talking earlier that we would always hear Thabo Mbeki is going to a non-aligned movement meeting. I remember there were meetings being held. They would put out a statement every now and again on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But what has actually happened to the movement? It feels obscure.
Yes, I would say it has gone. It has basically followed the ebbs and flows of non-alignment and ideologically based organizations throughout in the last 50 years. Let's remember when it was formed, we had a bipolar world. So, but now, come 1990, fall of the Berlin Wall, kind of we move away from the ideologically based groupings to kind of more developmentally based groupings, economic growth based groupings. So what it has done, it kind of died with some of these countries that died with it. One of them is Yugoslavia, and one of them, of course, is the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So it kind of followed the vagaries of international relations.
Right. We can't help the irony that here we are again with the former Soviet Union and now Russia. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some analysts have told VOA that the way African countries voted on U.S.-led resolutions to punish Russia at the United Nations, some voting in favor of those resolutions, some abstaining, some not voting at all, that all of this could somehow signal that there's a need or might be talks afoot to revive the non-aligned movement or kind of start a new one altogether. What's your take on that?
Well, it's not a misplaced assessment, this one, but there's an optimistic perspective about this, that, well, African countries have always sought to be non-aligned, and this is the right moment. So perhaps it's a way for them to demonstrate it in an effective, consequential way at the United Nations, in a kind of a loud way. So that's one. But a pessimistic take may be that, well, African countries, if you look at the non-aligned movement itself, it has kind of a checkered past based on the kind of basically the cornucopia of the countries that came to make it, right? You have very diverse countries. And many of these countries have since grown economically and hence have not found a need to coalesce around certain values that the Africans have actually been left behind on. One of them is economic development. Another one is foreign direct investment. So this new non-aligned movement then may, a kind of a neutral take maybe, may be time for it, but around economic growth, around shared values of how to develop, rather than ideology.
Pior, what surprised you the most in the way you saw African countries vote or not vote at the United Nations? Who surprised you the most?
Yes. Well, I was surprised by, let's see, I have the list here. Well, this was, let's look at it as a protest vote.
Okay.
So some of them that kind of surprised me was one, South Sudan, actually. Mm. South Sudan abstained, which is kind of a polite against, right? Let's not get carried away. I think the real countries that abstained, the real abstention, one might say, was the no recorded vote countries, eight of them. Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Ethiopia, Eswatini, Guinea, Guinea-Bissau, Morocco, and Togo. So this was kind of like, if you will, a real abstention, because these ones said, we don't even want to vote. Right. So that surprised me, how many countries actually would not. What I think another surprise would be how Lesotho and Botswana in Southern Africa. I have a map here of the kind of the countries of Southern Africa. This map usually, these are all the abstentions. Hmm. But you have Lesotho and Botswana. Right?
Right.
So usually SADC is singing from the same hymn sheet.
Correct. That's interesting. It's right. Pretty purple there.
So this is a surprise, but it shows kind of for SADC, this is a big split in opinion. So that was a surprise. This split in opinion where Botswana and Lesotho voted for the resolution to condemn Russia and Ukraine.
And did South Africa surprise you?
A big no. Hmm. A small yes. A small yes based on, so yes, it did surprise me because I was expecting that the head of state, current President Ramaphosa, he would be quite amenable as someone who's, you know, a human rights activist who has a long history in kind of navigating human rights abuses and going around them. So I would have expected him to be quite more amenable to something that condemns a violation of human rights. But when I kind of woke up from my stupor, I was a big no, because South Africa, it seems like it now knows exactly where its bread is buttered economically, and it's willing to follow this path in the arena of international relations. Well, it coheres with the relations that South Africa has. I'm sorry, I always must include China. Well, South Africa has a comprehensive strategic partnership with China. And as you said earlier on the show, that China has really wedded itself to the Russian side. And by consequence or extension, certain countries, including South Africa, have kind of read the tea leaves and are basically following this, saying, well, we don't want to be found on the wrong side of China via this Russian-Ukrainian event.
Also, I think Senegal, excuse me, surprised some people as well. But I want to come back to Cyril Ramaphosa, the man. Last week, he spoke finally to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. But that was 7 weeks after he spoke to Russian President Vladimir Putin. What do you make of the way Cyril Ramaphosa has navigated the situation so far?
Well, I credit this kind of awakening to... It's an awakening to kind of a very vociferous voice on the social media, so South Africa, Twitter, that kind of is pro-Ukraine. Well, it's been split, I would say, to be fair. But unexpectedly, there's been very, very vociferous condemnation of kind of the Russian side on Twitter. And some of these voices have been very influential voices in South Africa. And his ear has been attuned to some of these voices. It took a while, but it shows that he's listening to kind of these loud voices within the country. But what I make of it also is that he's a president that's trying to consolidate his power within South Africa. Most importantly, within the ANC. And the ANC always singing those old ideological, very melancholic songs about Russia, Soviet Union helped us during the struggle.
Nostalgia. So,
and in the skullduggery that takes place within the ANC with the upcoming elections just around the corner, many of his rivals are using this. So it shows that Ramaphosa is actually wise. He knows what his opponents within the ANC are going to use, and he's acting ahead of them. So we're seeing actually a wise decision and a balancing act.
And I want to stay on him because he says he has been asked to mediate any potential Russia-Ukraine talks. And I wonder if many people remember that Cyril Ramaphosa is a skilled mediator. I mean, he, of course, inside South Africa, he helped mediate those negotiations. But also outside of South Africa, the Northern Ireland, between the British and Northern Ireland, and he was part of the effort that culminated in the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. So given his words and actions so far, do you think that Cyril Ramaphosa can be seen as an honest broker in any potential Russia-Ukraine peace talks? And will other countries in the world see him as that, as someone who can be truly neutral on this situation?
He can certainly talk the talk of peace, and he has given, to be fair to him, he has given speeches where he kind of neutral speeches, where he said, well, we'd like to see peace prevail, which augurs well for him as a mediator. But South Africa's non-neutral stance on this, at least where it matters the most, in foreign policy, in kind of these interests that South Africa is embedded in as a nation state, and him as a head of that nation state, makes him quite conflicted as a peace broker. But he's quite an able person. And the credit to the Ukrainian ambassador in South Africa, who has been quite vocal on social media and has quite made a very good case for South Africa's involvement, neutral involvement. But Ramaphosa is distracted right now, to be fair. The elections in South Africa are coming up. There are a few purges that are taking place within the ANC, including the African National Congress's Women's League. So he has a lot on his plate. And many South Africans have been voicing this, even on social media, that, well, we have a lot of things going on right now that kind of we cannot afford to be availing ourselves, perhaps, to some of these endeavors. So there's a lot of decisions, very difficult decisions to make, and none of them will be easy ones.
And the broader picture, Pipo Kushle, where to from here for African countries? What do they do in the meantime? Because this war is going to come home to other countries around the world, including on the African continent. We've seen the skyrocketing fuel prices. There's the whole debate around wheat imports, etc., from Russia and Ukraine. These are all knock-on effects that are going to be felt on the continent, and this war can go on potentially for a very long time. What do countries do in the meantime, and how will this affect Russia's relations with African countries in terms of its commitments it's made to African countries? Can it fulfill those when it is engulfed in a full-scale war?
It's quite difficult. The simple answer to that, it's quite difficult. Almost it cannot, because this is a very serious matter that's going on. But unfortunately, for African countries, there's always been kind of recently a general malaise. In 2020, of all the foreign direct investment around the world, only 4% of it went to Africa. 1% of that was in Northern Africa, and 0.3% of that was in South Africa. So 2.7% of all the foreign direct investment in the world has actually been dedicated to Africa. So African countries have been smarting. They may be forgiven to have kind of a fatigue about some of these things that happen, that they see as happening far away from their shores when they have bigger issues. But you are quite right. In a globalized world, which is increasingly flatter with the very ease of communication, these things don't stay far away from them. So African countries, as you can see, even with SADC, have big decisions to make. And these decisions are going to be conflicting for many of them. And I will say it will come down to kind of national security and economic development. And you must look out where their bread is buttered. And it's buttered, you know, increasingly in the East.
We saw earlier, and this is my final question to you, we saw earlier the U.S. State Department counselor saying that America isn't taking notes and that they don't see the relationship really changing for the worse between them and African countries. What's your take on that? Is this inevitably going to influence, perhaps not positively, relationships, will it sour relationships between some African countries and the United States, depending on the way these countries voted?
That's a very good question. It's a very difficult question. These able diplomats that you've spoken to at the State Department, they know very well what a complex situation they have on the African continent. Well, and let's not forget, 28, more than half of the African countries voted for, and so which gave the other ones who abstained cover. only one voted against. So the African countries most likely, I see a lot of them, kind of taking the legalistic route to say, look, we didn't vote against it, we abstained, and here are the compelling reasons. And some of these reasons are quite sound and are based on local politics, which all able diplomats actually understand. So I would say we'd have to wait maybe for a succession of resolutions and see if there's a pattern. Then we can make kind of a conclusive decision to say, well, African countries have now picked the side. And judging by the votes in the resolution to kind of take Russia out of the United Nations Human Rights Council, we have a mixed bag. We have a mixed bag. So it's quite a fluid situation we have.
So we're going to look at what's ahead and subsequent resolutions at the United Nations to see where things fall, where the chips fall then. Pibo Kushle Mnyandu, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. Pibo Kushle Mnyandu is from Howard University, where he teaches in the African Studies Department. And we're going to take another break here. And when we come back, we'll bring you the stories of Africans who fled Ukraine but decided to stay in Eastern Europe instead of returning home. We'll have that story next. Welcome back. Thousands of African students fled Ukraine in February when Russia invaded that country. Some returned home, but many others fled to neighboring Poland. However, they soon discovered that life in Poland as a refugee is vastly different as life as a student in Ukraine. VOA's Karina Chowdhury tells us more.
I never imagined I could be in this situation, seriously. I could remember I left Ukraine with two clothes. We went there to study, but at the end of the day, something happened, and we just have to run for our life, you know? This is safety first, and that is exactly what we did.
Adedayo Okumboboye and Sholom Boladeoku were close to finishing their education at the university in the Ukrainian city of Lusk when Russia invaded Ukraine. In a matter of days, the Nigerian students found themselves displaced by conflict. Traveling by bus and walking, the pair managed to make it across the border into neighboring Poland. Once inside the country, they faced new challenges.
Even if these people, the black people, would approach the border, they would be pushed to the back of the queue at the Ukrainian border, and then in Poland they would not be admitted accommodation.
Margaret Ohia Novak is a Nigerian Polish human rights activist. Her organization, the Alliance for Black Justice in Poland, helps African students stranded at the Polish-Ukrainian border. That is how Ohia Novak met Adedayo and Shalom. Ohia Novak says the conflict in Ukraine is demonstrating how race and nationality prevent non-European refugees from getting help.
In Poland, the message was that, oh, we are accepting refugees because these people look like us. And not only in Poland, but in Europe at large, these people are civilized, that they are white people just like us, and so on. And I started thinking, what would happen to me if I was in this situation? I heard many instances of people, and I know even people that were waiting for the accommodation to come. So we arranged accommodation, and then at the last moment, those people that offered accommodation would say, oh, but it was for real Ukrainian. It was for real refugees, not for somebody that was accidentally here. And obviously, some would say it was because they are black. Explicitly, some would not say it, but it was somewhere in the air.
In March, the Polish parliament passed a law allowing Ukrainian nationals fleeing the war to stay in Poland for 18 months. There, they have access to health care and jobs. However, the law does not apply to non-Ukrainian refugees, leaving many Africans without options. Tade Daniel Omotosho runs the group Nigerians in Diaspora Poland. He helps Africans apply for residency permits so they can live in Poland and enroll at universities.
The idea is they don't want you to stay. They just want you to move on. When you come in as a non-Ukrainian, you're just allowed to stay for 15 days. So what we did is that for as many people that want to stay, we made sure that within that 15 days, they put in an application to the Home Office. If they are denied by the Home Office, you know, they would have no option than to either go back home or apply for the asylum program or the refugee program, which is not the best.
Omotosho's organization houses African students in Warsaw while they wait to hear the outcome of their applications. Students like Abanulor Anderson is one of 50 living in this house.
So most of us don't have it dying on us. So having a place to lay your head, having someone to like feed you and a whole lot of it, so I think it's good. It's the best we could have right now.
In Lublin, Ohia Novak is helping Adedayo and Shalom with their residency permits and university applications. But it is complicated and there are no guarantees.
If the university admits them, they have to pay again for their studies, even though they had paid in Ukraine for university already. So what we are doing now is to try to apply for a fee waiver to universities, but there's no systemic solution for it, really.
But maybe after the admission and all this stuff, then we can try to reason them and talk to them if they could waive the admission for us or they could reduce it for us. Because according to what I heard, I think these people are just, they favor the Ukrainians, and which is very, very bad. All of us are studying there.
Because we also are human beings, Renat. So we need help as well.
Ohia Novak has found Adedayo and Shalom a place to stay. Adedayo is grateful, but cannot help missing his life back in Ukraine.
Ukraine is, before the old stuff started, the war and everything, is a very peaceful country. And the citizens of the country, like, they are friendly to us.
Instead of waiting for graduation day in Ukraine, Adedayo and Shalom are now waiting to hear about their residency status in Poland. While his future is uncertain, for Adedayo, going back to Nigeria is not an option.
Because there is nothing there. Even those people living in Nigeria want to leave. So me going back there is not really, it's going to be a wrong decision for me. So, and I prefer staying here because I know sooner or later everything will be fine.
Karina Chaudhry, VOA News, Poland.
Karina Chaudhry, there was some excellent reporting from Poland. And that is where we will leave it for this week. Remember to follow us on social media. We've got great stories for you there. And join us next week for a special episode. My colleague Peter Clotty will be interviewing Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. Thank you so much to all our affiliate stations airing Straight Talk Africa across the African continent. Thanks to my guests and to you, our audience, for joining me on television, radio and online. Thank you so much for always listening and always watching. I'll see you next time. Goodbye.